Welcome to Messing About in Ships, episode number 23 for May 16th, 2008. This week we bring you Captain Kelly Sweeney with a Mariner's Perspective, a Storm Watch, and then a special edition of Sea Stories with John interviewing the C-130 pilot involved in the Sean Seymour 2 rescue. Finally, we bring you some pod safe music. Hi, I'm Peter Mello from seafever.org, and I'm here alone this week. John is actually traveling, so he wasn't able to get, we weren't able to get together tonight. But we do have a very special show for you. In addition to our regular segments, we have a very special interview that John did with a C-130 pilot involved with the Sean Seymour 2 rescue. You might be familiar with that. Back in episode number 12, John interviewed Nevada Smith, who was a helicopter pilot, and that was an amazing, amazing interview. If you haven't listened to it, go please check it out. Then last week, we had a special guest host, Rob Stormer, who with John had a great discussion about EPIRBs. Next week, John has interviewed this week the captain and owner of the Sean Seymour 2, so we'll be playing that for you next week. We're going to kind of save all the comments and internet ports of call this week and jump right into what we have, the Mariner's Perspective with Captain Kelly Sweeney. So here it is.
Ahoy, shipmates. This is Captain Kelly Sweeney with another Mariner's Perspective. How many of you have had bad food at a restaurant and gotten ill? I have. We don't even want to go to my vacation in Mexico a number of years ago, or I made a bad choice one night. In any case, when you eat at a bad restaurant in town or wherever you live, you can avoid that restaurant in the future. And interestingly enough, the people who work there actually have to be certified that they understand health regulations, including how to properly cook the food, store it, and personal hygiene. Unfortunately, for those of us who go to sea for a living, we don't get that kind of treatment. The only requirement the Coast Guard has for someone to be able to serve food on board a vessel is that they have a doctor's statement that they are not have any communicable diseases, that they do not have any communicable diseases. Of course, that doesn't mean they understand anything about how to properly prepare food and serve it safely and cleanly. I have experience on a number of vessels. I was a member on an oceanographic ship, a chief officer on an oceanographic ship, and about a quarter of the crew, including myself, came down with food poisoning. When I confronted the chief steward about it, after I noticed that he had served rancid potato chips for lunch, juice way past its expiration date, and kept leftovers in the refrigerator for weeks, I told him, a quarter of the crew has become ill on your food. What do you have to say about that? He said, oh, what's wrong with a little diarrhea? It'll clean your pipes out for you. Now, not all vessels have that problem. Seafarers International Union is one of the industry groups that really makes sure that the people who are serving the food on board their ships are well trained. Just to wash dishes in the galley of an SIU vessel, you have to have weeks of training on galley sanitation and cleanliness. To actually become a chief steward and plan menus and supervise food preparation, you need months and months of training and 2 years of experience. I believe personally it's time for the industry to recognize the importance of food on board vessels. Actually, federal regulations require that companies provide food that is fit for use. However, they do not require that the food is prepared in a healthful and safe manner. And it's time for that to change. The requirements for being a professional mariner have increased greatly for engineers, those on deck, and officers up in the wheelhouse, but not for cooks. We need to take the lead and make the changes that countries like England have in requiring cooks to prove that they understand safe food preparation and that they demonstrate that ability. Till next time, I wish you all smooth sailing, and thanks for listening to A Mariner's Perspective on another great Messing About in Ships podcast. So long, shipmates, for now. Smooth sailing.
This is Robin Storm, and this is Storm Watch for the week of May 12, 2008. There are no gale warnings for the Atlantic provinces, though severe weather is still predominant throughout the sector. The Bay of Bengal. There is a low-pressure system currently over the east-central Bay of Bengal, adjoining coastal Burma, South African coast, northern parts of the North Andaman Sea, and the Gulf of Marban. All mariners take notice. This is a dangerous potential storm. The United States. To date, there have been some 910 reported tornadoes. Severe weather continues to strike the Southwest and Gulf Coast. Remember, be ready. Make sure your family has a plan in case of severe weather emergency. Log on to www.beready.gov. This has been Robin Storm for Messing About in Ships. May the fair winds be with you always.
Welcome to Messing About on Ships. I'm Captain John Conrad of GCaptain.com, and today we bring you the second part in our story about the rescue of the Sean Seymour II. We originally highlighted this story on GCaptain's blog, as well as Robin Storm's blog, and last week we brought you the podcast with the helicopter crew that did the actual rescue. We had Commander Nevada Smith, Lieutenant Nelson, Petty Officer Higgins, and Petty Officer Drew Dazzo. So if you haven't listened to that podcast, go back and listen to that one first, and come back, and this is part two. So the Sean Seymour II, we're going to read a little excerpt from the final log entry. The captain of the vessel has a blog. His name is Jean-Pierre, and he posted a little account of the what happened that on May 7th during the rescue. So we'll start here. By late afternoon on May 6th, the winds were sustained at over 70 knots and seas were building fast. I estimated seas were well into 25 feet by dusk, but after adding approximately 100 feet of drogue line, the vessel handled smoothly over the next 8 hours, advancing with the seas at about 6 knots. By late afternoon into the evening, the winds were sustained above 74 knots, and a crew member recorded a peak of 85 knots. Growing and irregular seas were the primary concern, as in the very early hours of the morning, the boat was increasingly struck by intermittent waves on the port side. Crew had to be positioned against the starboard side as both were tossed violently across the boat. Water began to accumulate, seemingly fed through the stern engine room air cowls. I believe, in retrospect, the goosenecks were insufficient with the pitch of a larger waves as they were breaking into the stern. He goes on to talk about the knockdown of the vessel and then continues to write, "After the knockdown, I knew there were already structural damage and that we had lost control of the vessel. I pulled the E-perb, which initially functioned, but the strobe stopped and the intensity of the light diminished rapidly to the extent that I did not know if the Coast Guard received that signal. All of the communications, except the handheld VHF, were down. Single sideband antenna on the backstay was gone. DSC VHF down, and the backup antenna was inaccessible. Iridium was soaked in the roll. The EPIRB with GPS functionality was not working, and our primary EPIRB was seemingly lost to a sea when the hard Dodger sheared. At 2:53 hours, we were struck violently again and began to roll to 180 degrees. As the vessel appeared to stabilize in the position, I unlocked the cabin way roof to exit and see where the life raft was." And he continues the story, which we will have posted a link to on our blog, on our show notes. But this is where you guys came in and with us today for the second part of our focus on the Shore and Seymour 2. We have the pilot of the HC-130H spotter plane called the Rescue 1502, Lieutenant Alstrand. Good afternoon, Lieutenant.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. So the Shore and Seymour 2 is in this terrible sea, and he's got very limited communications. What point did you guys get the call there?
We received a call about 4 or 5 a.m., actually Monday morning on the 7th of May, and we were actually, it's kind of interesting, I've only seen this happen this one time. We had to relocate the day before from our air station here in Elizabeth City at the Coast Guard base up to Norfolk International due to the fact that this subtropical storm Andrea that was causing all the problems for the Shore and Seymour actually was causing winds to come out of the due north, and they were above our crosswind limitation, and our runway runs east-west, so that was causing us a major problem. So we had to relocate the airplane up to Norfolk International, where the runway was more aligned to the north and we could take off into the wind. So we actually took off at 5 o'clock Monday morning, May 7th, and took off due to an EPIRB, or an ELT detection by our parent command, which was Atlantic Area. And they gave us the coordinates out there southeast of North Carolina, about 180 miles, to go out there and take a look and see what we could find.
So you guys get the call from your command station, and there are two types of EPIRBs, a GPS EPIRB, which will give you the exact coordinates, and a traditional EPIRB. Can you talk a little bit about the difference?
The traditional EPIRB sends out a signal on 121.5, and for military, they also send it out on 243 on UHF. And one of the things that we have on board our aircraft is a direction finder that homes in on the 121.5 signal. So once we have to be close. So what happens is the land area gets a pretty good idea of where that signal's coming from. They give us a lat long and a search box to look at once we get there. And then once we arrive on scene at the location of the source, we turn on our direction finding equipment, which is what we did in this case, and we home in on that signal.
So take me to the morning of the flight. You get the call, you're airborne, and you're heading to the scene. What are the preparations you guys do at that point?
On our way out, we discuss as a crew what type of situation we're looking at. In this case, there were multiple EPIRBs or ELTs out there, so we decided to go ahead and prepare some of our MA3 kits, which is it's a kit that has what we call 5 cans. You kind of have to use your imagination on this. It's 5 cans that are strung out along a 1,000-foot line of polypropylene cable, and in each of those cans, they have certain functions. There's 3 cans that have life rafts that we can blow up and deploy. Then 2 of them have rescue items such as food, water, mirrors, flares, anything that you would need if you were going to be out on the sea for an extended amount of time. Obviously, because we're a fixed-wing aircraft, we don't have the ability to extract you out of the water, but we certainly have the ability to deploy life rafts and survival gear to the people in peril until they can be either or a Samaritan vessel that's close by.
Interesting. So what happened that morning, specifically?
We received the phone call, and we immediately went to Norfolk International. We checked the weather while the crew prepared the aircraft. Because we had to relocate the aircraft, we have about a 45-minute launch window. We saw that subtropical depression or that low out there was gaining intensity and was really kicking the winds here. We had 40-knot winds here at the air station, again, which forced us to actually leave the air station to go up to Norfolk. We took off. We immediately put an MA3 kit along with some other survival gear there on the back. We arrived on scene, and I'll tell you what, it's one of those memories I'll never forget. We descended down in what we call IMC conditions, or instrument meteorological conditions, and as we came down, you couldn't see a thing, and we have limits on how far down we can go to the water and not break out, meaning how far down we can get before we have to break out of the ceiling in order to see the ocean surface, because you're completely on instruments. And as we went down, we finally did break out. We had a varying ceiling between 500 feet and 1,000 feet. And I'll tell you what, as we went down, we were looking at our instruments. It was telling us that we were having anywhere between sustained 60 to 70 knot winds with gust up to 80, and that right there puts you in hurricane strength winds. So that was an eye-opener and caught our attention at that point. And then as we continued down, when we finally did break out of the clouds in the ceiling, and we saw the water below us, it was a sight I'll never forget. It was not blue, placid water. It was green and white. It was churning, and I think the thing that caught all of us and left us all kind of speechless there was seeing 50-foot waves, one on top of the other. And I've never seen waves that big before since that time.
Wow, amazing. And that low ceiling, I assume that really reduces the amount of surface area you can see from any one position. Is that a real concern?
Actually, in this case, in most cases, once you break through the ceiling, usually, unless you have some kind of ground fog, it doesn't obscure your forward visibility. But until you break out of that ceiling, you don't see a thing. You're what we call zero vis. But once we broke out of the ceiling, we could actually see about 3 to 4 miles ahead of us. We did run into some. Now again, the ceiling would vary from 500 feet to 1,000 feet. So once we broke out, we would still run into some lower ceilings there. But generally, we could keep about 3 miles vis in front of us. There was an occasion we ran into a rain cloud or some low-hanging clouds there. But for the most part, once we broke out, we could see in front of us. But again, keep in mind that we were dealing with issues like rain, sea spray, and just a general darkness due to the fact that the cloud cover was so intense.
Interesting. So you break down through the cloud cover and you approach the position. Who are the members of your team, and what are their duties at that point to find the craft?
Sure. We have two pilots, an aircraft commander and a co-pilot. And obviously, the main function of the pilots is to actually fly the aircraft. We have a flight engineer that sits in between us. It's his job to manage the aircraft system, such as pressurization, electrical, fuel. This is an older aircraft. As a matter of fact, the aircraft was built in 1973, so it's not a computerized aircraft, and it still has a lot of twist knobs. We have 8 fuel tanks on board, so we have there's a lot of work in terms of deciding which fuel tanks you want to burn out of and which ones you want to save, and along with the pressurization electrical issues in terms of de-icing. That's his primary job. We have a radar operator / navigator who sits behind the flight engineer. His job is obviously to look through the radar and see if he can see anything on the surface. And then we have a radio operator. And his job becomes very important in this. He's kind of the unsung hero in some SAR cases because of how much radio traffic is going on. In this case, you may have multiple aircraft, multiple vessels, multiple search vessels, multiple rescue units, and those the radios can get busy and clogged very quickly, and it's his job to keep on top of it. And then moving to the back of the aircraft, as you know, the C-130 is a rather large cargo-carrying aircraft. Obviously, we've converted it to our specific use. But in the back, we have two more personnel. One is a drop master, who it's his job to ready the SAR equipment and to drop it out the back of the aircraft, because we have the ability to open up the back like a clamshell, and we can do that in midair. And then he has an assistant, a basic airman, who will help him with that.
Interesting. So take me through the actual events. You break through the cloud cover. Was it easy to find the Sean Seymour 2? And when you did find it, how do you keep an eye on that craft?
No, it was actually very difficult, and this is I'm hoping people who hear this, please take heed. When we broke out, again, keep in mind that we're dealing with the weather conditions. We're dealing with low clouds, rain, again, churning greenish-white seas with 50-foot waves. The only thing that we had was our direction-finding equipment, which told us the location of the signal. And so we would fly over that signal. We made several passes over it and saw nothing. Because keep in mind, we're moving at 150 to 170 knots per hour, which is basically 2.5 to 3 miles a minute. And we would fly over the source. Our needle would then swing back, telling us that we've overflown it, and we would turn around and come back, which was kind of an interesting aerial feat because of the 80-knot winds we were battling against. That was really kicking us around. We went over the source several times, and I'll tell you a backup story of this when I get done. Finally, on our third or fourth pass, going back over the signal where our direction finding equipment was telling us where the vessel was located, we saw a red flare being shot in the air, and that's how we knew there were survivors down there. And at that point, we went to the location of the flare, and we saw at the time what we really couldn't know for sure, but what appeared to be some people hanging on to some debris, which later turned out to be one of their survival rafts, but we couldn't tell. And we finally caught sight of them, and we at that point continued to do like a racetrack pattern over them. And again, because of the weather conditions and the IMC conditions and the sea conditions, we would only see them every other pass. It would because of the how fast they were drifting and because of the sea state at the time. And we did this for 2 hours until the about 2.5 hours until the rescue helicopter arrived.
Interesting. So we're interested to hear this backup story.
The backup story is I actually had dinner with one of the survivors about a month or two ago, and in talking with him, he was asking a lot of questions. This is one of the members on the crew named Phil Snell, and he said he asked why I can't remember what started, but basically he said something that said, well, when you saw us, I noticed you kept overflying us. And I said, Phil, we didn't see you the first time. We just had a direction finding equipment that told us this was the spot, and we flew over it 2, 3, 4 times until you finally shot that flare off. And had you not shot that flare off, I don't know if I'd be talking to you today. And because that was what finally honed us in on where they exactly were and told us where to exactly look to get what we call eyes on target. And Phil, you could tell it really jolted him because he assumed that we had seen him from the moment we arrived on scene and had set up an overhead pattern, and it was news to him that we did not see him for the first 2 to 3 passes. It was not until he shot off that red flare that we were actually able to exactly put eyes on target. And I think that's an important lesson for anybody out there that when you're dealing with, especially for the people, for the fishermen and for the pleasure boaters that go far offshore, when you're going to be dealing with a rescue fixed-wing aircraft like a C-130 that's moving at such a fast speed, you really need to have packed your rescue supplies very well, because in some weather conditions it may be very difficult for us to see you, and if you don't have a flare or some kind of other equipment that would lead us right there on scene to show us where you are, it can be very difficult, if not next to impossible sometimes, to locate the target.
Great advice. And Commander Smith is also talking about staying with your vessel. Does that really help you locate it?
Absolutely. Anything that, obviously, if you're in the water, now you're talking about just a head poking out of the water. If you're in a raft or some other device, anything that's bigger that makes it easier for the eyeball to see, that's always better. And again, in our case, with them shooting off that red flare, that's what finally... Well, we were able to put, again, eyes on target, because that first 3 passes, we did not see them. All we were going off of was electronic homing equipment, and we just, based on those sea conditions, when you're up flying at 500 feet at 170 knots, 3 miles a minute, those sea conditions can make it very difficult to detect a target. So, again, make sure you're well-packed and make sure you have all your necessary equipment, so it makes it that much easier for us to find you.
So tell us a little bit about the handoff to the helicopter to Commander Smith and his crew.
Sure. We once we located the raft, again, because of the sea state, we started plotting their position in our flight computer, and they were drifting so quick that as we continued to orbit them in this racetrack pattern, we were able to only see them every other pass. And so we were always in fear and always worried that we were going to lose them. No, once we located the survivors there in their raft, we took up an overhead pattern for the next 2.5 hours, flying anywhere between 200 to 500 feet above them. At all times, the number one thing we were trying to do was keep eyes on target. They were drifting at a pretty good rate, and once again, combined with the weather on scene and the sea state, we were only able to see them on every other pass. So we were always concerned, always worried that we would lose them at some point. During this time, we had made an emergency call using our HF radio equipment back to the air station and back to our command center, saying, "Launch the ready helicopter to come out and pick them up." So while we were, and that was a pretty good transit for them. Again, we stayed overhead for 2.5 hours, battling low ceilings, 80 knot winds, all the while with just below us with the 50 foot waves, and just trying to keep the aircraft airborne. And we did that for the next 2.5 hours. And again, to show you how difficult it is to see people, even if it's three of them in a raft. The Hilo arrived on scene as we flew over them, and they couldn't find them. And we had to try and give them directions, and again, they still couldn't find them. And finally, at one point when we flew the Hilo and the raft, we said, "Turn right. They're right there." And then at that point, the Hilo crew turned their heads to the right, got good eyes on them, and were able to extract the three survivors up to the helicopter.
Great. And mission was a success, huh?
Mission was successful. At that time, what we did is we stayed with the helicopter, and we escorted it back to Marine Corps Air Station Cherry Point, North Carolina, because that was the closest military base, and actually was the closest airfield on land. So we escorted them back to that point. We'd taken off with about 6 hours of fuel, and we were down. We'd eaten up about five at this point, so we landed with the helicopter as we escorted it. Landed, we took on a whole nother batch of gas and took back off and spent another 6 to 7 hours searching for some other vessels that were still missing at that time and still are missing, unfortunately. And altogether, we flew 12.1 hours that day searching for the Sean Seymour II as well as other sailing vessels.
Wow, and a total of 12 saves, is that correct?
There was. Not all by us. We were only responsible for the Sean Seymour II saves, but because of the number of vessels that were caught in subtropical, it was later on called Subtropical Storm Andrea, because of all the vessels caught in there, that was the number of people that were saved. There were a number of vessels that were put in peril that day by that storm.
Amazing story. And I want to get back to this ME3 kit. I've done a lot of survival training as a licensed master mariner, and I haven't heard of this kit yet. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
John, I hate to do this. I just got told to call the command center. Can I set down the phone for one? Like, it'll be 30 seconds. I got to call over there.
No
we
worries.
May be getting a SAR launch. I'll be right back. John, are you there?
Yes.
I'm sorry about that. I apologize.
Oh, no worries. Everything's good now?
Everything's good. I thought it was dealing with a question that I can answer for him later. So I apologize. Ready to continue.
Oh, great. So we were talking about the MA3 kit?
Sure. The MA3 kit, on board the C-130, we go out with several pieces of equipment. And in this case, the MA3 kit is designed to be deployed from the back of a C-130 in the event that a vessel is in distress or has already been in distress and is sunk and there are people in the water. It is a it's a contraption that is five canisters. If you're using your imagination, these canisters are probably the size of a small barrel, and they're attached by 250 foot. The whole cord is polypropylene line that's approximately 1,000 feet long. And it's divided up into 250-foot segments. So you have two canisters at the end and then three canisters in the middle, and they're all connected by 250-foot increments of line. And the MA3 kit, specifically the canisters on the end and the canister in the middle, is a 8-person life raft that we can either have the choice of either deploying uninflated or inflated. And the two other canisters contain rescue items, and there's a whole laundry list. But basically, there's just general essential items like blankets, mirrors to signaling mirrors, fresh water, food, whistles, sunscreen, just about anything that somebody would need who's going to be unfortunately stranded on the water for a significant amount of time. And what we do is we fly a pattern. Let's assume that we find somebody who's in dire straits, and their vessel is either sinking or has sunk, and there are people in the water. We fly a pattern where we drop this out the back of our aircraft to them, and based on, and there's a lot of factors that go into this, but the bottom line is that you deploy it to them so that they can climb into the rafts and then use the rescue gear that's provided.
Do you tend to deploy it up one and let it drift down, or you try to get it right at their as close as possible?
Great question. We do it two different ways. If it's people in the water, we're assuming the vessel sunk and now they're just lying in the water, we deploy it upwind with the idea that the rafts and the canisters will move faster due to the winds and ocean current than the people in the water. So the aim is we try and deploy it 50 to 70 feet upwind of them so that once it hits the water, it drifts down on the people in need. If, on the other hand, we're deploying to a vessel, we actually deploy it downwind of them so that the idea is that the vessel has more freeboard and will drift faster than the actual canisters, and then the vessel will drift into the life rafts.
Sure, great. And what goes into the decision of deploying this? Is it just if the helicopter can't make it out and you guys have to go in, or are there other reasons you might want to deploy this?
No, we would deploy it any time that we would, again, and it's all based on what we find on scene. We would deploy it any time that we were concerned that a vessel was either sinking so that they would be in the need of the life rafts at some point in the near future, or the vessel has already sunk, then we would definitely deploy it to them. But we would always take the most conservative, safe course. So if there's any doubt that the vessel may be going down, we would deploy that to them to have in case it does eventually sink.
Well, most of our readers of GCaptain.com and listeners of this podcast, our target audience is officers and crew members aboard large commercial ships. What tips do you have for them?
Well, again, it's an interesting question because it depends on. I'll give you my perspective as a fixed-wing C-130 rescue pilot. What we need most of all to help, you know, assuming a worst case scenario that a vessel has gone down and that there are people in the water, the most important thing for us is the ability to stand out and get our attention once we get on scene. You know, we're going to be given a large search area, and we're going to keep eyes on the water as we get to that area and search it. But the most important thing is to make yourself stand out. So, bright clothing. If you go in the water, bright clothing. Flares, anything that helps us see you is the most important thing. And in this case, again, what really did it was the fact that on that third pass, they sent out the Sean Seymour crew sent up a flare, and that brought us right to them. I'd hate to think of what would happen if we didn't. Hopefully, we still would have found them, but certainly the flare made all the difference in the world at that time. So my tip is, if you go in the water, try and wear something bright colored. So when we're up in that aircraft traveling 2.5 to 3 miles a minute, we can easily spot you in the water because of bright orange, because of some kind of bright coloring. Or more importantly, any kind of rescue flare or lighting will really draw our attention, whether it's day or night, or some kind of smoke device. Anything that stands out. And also, if there's obviously some floating debris that's bigger than the person, if you can hold on to that and keep that, obviously, that also tends to draw our attention. Anything that's eye-catching that's bigger than the average person. That's a big ocean out there. We're usually given big search areas, and we do our best. But anything that person on the other end can do to help us is always welcomed.
So the EPIRBs, SARTs, and VHF radios are good to get you to the general area, and then you really need a little more to get pinpointed, huh?
Well, actually, assuming that they have a working handheld Victor radio in their possession and they can tune up 121.5, we can home right in on that. We can, as we talk to them, assuming it's working, we can home right in on that. But again, just like with the Sean Seymour, that was some extreme conditions. But because of the weather, even though we homed right in on them, because of the sea state and the clouds and the rain and the 50-foot waves and the swirling waters, we really couldn't see them until they lit that flare off. So obviously radios are a wonderful thing. We have direction finding equipment on board. We can home in there and get there. But once we're there, it's going to be what SAR pilots have been doing for the last 100 years. It's going to be that getting that eye on target, and anything that helps to get that eye on target is going to make the difference.
Now that's really good stuff. And anytime a storm comes up on our weather facts, Captain once told me you can tell the experienced guys from the new guys. The new guys are all excited to be in their first storms, and the experienced guys go, oh, crap, here we go again.
I don't blame them. I think I like the idea of the experienced guys.
Yeah, and those late nights at sea and bad weather, for us, but also for our families at home, knowing you guys are out there really, really helps get through those difficult days. So I want to give our big thanks to you and your crew.
Well, it was our pleasure, and thank you for broadcasting this.
All right. Any final tips for our listeners and comments?
No. It's just it was one of those that rescue was probably one of the most significant I've been involved with, based on the weather and obviously the positive outcome. And as much as exciting and interesting flying it was, I hope to have to never do it again.
Yeah, that's the key, and that's, I think, the key for all the mariners listening. Be prepared beforehand, and hopefully you guys don't have to come and rescue us. So I appreciate you coming on the podcast today, and have a good evening.
John, you take care, and we look forward to working with you in the future.
Well, that was a great interview by John of the C-130 pilot from the Sean Seymour 2 Rescue. Look forward to next week's interview with the owner and captain of the vessel. If you want to get a hold of us and leave a comment about this or any other show, please do. You can get us at the show blog, which is messingaboutinships.com. You can email us and send an audio comment if you want to, podcast@messingaboutinships.com. You can get John at his blog over at gcaptain.com, and I'm at seafever.org, and that's SEA-FEVER.org. You can call us up in Skype, and we can take your comment, and we can integrate it into the show here, and our Skype address is MAIS Podcast. That's MAIS Podcast. And finally, we have a Skype in number, and that's 206-973-7000. You can leave a voicemail there. So this week's music comes from the PodSafe Music Network. It's a song I heard C.C. Chapman play, I believe, over at Accident Hash. It's a band called Monk, and the song is called Superheroes. And he asks in the song, where are superheroes gone? And I think today's podcast and number 12 certainly give us an answer to his question. So look forward to talking to you next week.